The Titans of Trial podcast is sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.
From the Florida Justice Association, these are the Titans of Trial.
We reject the attitude that trial lawyers need to be junkyard dogs, and we work for change in society in a different way. Hopefully, through some of our cases, we've made society a safer place.
Bob Sporer talks about his vision beyond the law and how a long walk down a dark road one night put him on a path to success.
I got a call from the boss on a Saturday morning, and he said, Sporer, he said, I need your help on this case. And I thought, hot damn, that's great. This is my chance to get off the bench and get into the game.
And about the importance of personal credibility in the practice of law.
Every time you appear in front of a judge or in front of a mediator or go to a deposition or a hearing with other attorneys, you're either making a deposit in that bank account of credibility or you're making a withdrawal. And if you get to the point where you're overdrawn on your credibility bank account, you can't recover from that.
Welcome to the Titans of Trial, featuring the personal stories of the men and women who've made a difference to the practice of trial law in Florida. I'm Paul Jess, Executive Director of the Florida Justice Association. Admittedly, his practice of law seems like one disaster after another. But that's okay for Bob Sporer of Jacksonville, who specializes in aviation and maritime law. Disaster has become his specialty. He and the firm he founded have recovered more than $1 billion for victims and their families, and achieved safety improvements that benefit all of us. His notable cases include the sinking of the El Faro cargo ship with all 33 souls aboard during a tropical storm in 2015. Bob Sporer is also a motorcycle riding, airplane piloting attorney who knows about risks. He has a reputation for taking on tough cases against major opponents with long odds and winning. He's a member of the Inner Circle of Advocates, an invitation-only organization of the top 100 trial lawyers in the country, as well as the International Association of Barristers. Bob has been honored with the Florida Justice Association's B.J. Masterson Award for high ethical standards and professionalism. He's also a Crystal Eagle Award winner. Bob Sporer sat down with Florida Justice Association radio host Harvey Bennett in December 2017 to discuss his trial focus on mastery of the facts, the keys to success that he shares with others, and how he's kept his 1960s idealism in changing times.
Bob, your specialty is aircraft disasters and other disasters, among them a $22.9 million jury verdict resulting from an Army Black Hawk helicopter incident, most recently the El Faro cargo ship sinking from Jacksonville to Puerto Rico. The NTSB just came out with its final report. That's an interesting line of work.
You know, we're privileged, Harvey, to have the opportunity to represent families in major litigation like the two that you mentioned and others. These are all challenging cases. They are cases that are important to the aviation community or the maritime community. You mentioned El Faro. Jacksonville, of course, is a huge seaport and a big maritime community here. And everyone has followed that story with great interest. And my hope is that because of the litigation, because of the NTSB and the Coast Guard investigations, that measures will be taken and procedures put in place to prevent other catastrophes like the El Faro.
How did you end up in that line of trial law?
I'm pleased to be referred cases by a number of other law firms and lawyers. We have a reputation, if you will, for taking on tough cases against major opponents with long odds and litigated against the federal government, major manufacturers, professional groups, et cetera. So a good deal of our work comes from very good lawyers who have cases that for one reason or another, they want to associate our firm on the case. And we're always pleased to be able to assist.
Now, with aircraft, I understand you have a special interest. You yourself are a pilot, right?
I am a pilot. I'm board certified in aviation law, and we have four other lawyers here who are pilots and four attorneys total who are board certified in aviation law. And that's sort of a niche, kind of like admiralty work, in that, as I said, very good lawyers who handle other types of trials are wary of getting involved in a case involving an aircraft disaster because there are certain aspects of the law which are unique, and they're worried about not being aware of those.
One of your clients remarked about your firm, all the kindness, ethics, morality that they encountered among you and your staff. Those are adjectives normally not associated by the general public with trial law. Why and how important is that?
You know, we reject the attitude that trial lawyers need to be junkyard dogs. And I think that, frankly, when we are honored to represent a family who has undergone some type of a tragedy, we want to bring to that representation an understanding of what they've gone through and help them resolve their issues as efficiently and economically and fairly as we can, whether it's going to trial or reaching a settlement or a mediation. And I think that the attributes of an advocate are not necessarily what people associate with the mean-spirited trial lawyer who's always trying to get the last edge on the opponent. I think many of these cases can resolve in a win-win situation for everyone.
Bring that back around to some of your most famous cases, the Black Hawk helicopter case, the Blackwater case where Army folks lost their life in a plane crash in Afghanistan.
Right. So what we want to accomplish, in my view, success would mean resolving a case so that a family has some type of financial support for their loss, but also where the defendant has changed a practice, a policy, a procedure, a manufacturer has changed a warning, has changed the design of a product, an aircraft company has put in place procedures to prevent this type of a tragedy from occurring, or a professional implements new procedures so that a surgery that has gone wrong hopefully will not occur again. To me, that's the quintessential definition of success for what we do, is where we have made a financial recovery for our client and help them through a difficult time. But almost equally importantly, we have seen that there's a change taking place in the defense so that that won't happen again.
Now, you're a hands-on kind of guy, I understand. Tell us about your famous story among locals here, that walk you took one dark night down Mayport Road near Naval Air Station Mayport.
So I was a young lawyer. I've been practicing law for, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes, and was privileged to be a young associate working with Matthews, Osborne, and Ehrlich, a very good insurance defense firm here in town, and was working with Ray Ehrlich on a case that every young lawyer in the firm wanted to be involved with, and it involved a terrible accident out on Mayport Road where a young sailor was walking down the side of the road and was hit by a pickup truck owned by the city or the county. And this was before we had sovereign immunity. There was significant insurance coverage. Walter Beckham, legendary lawyer from Miami, represented the young man who was grievously injured, and Ehrlich represented the county. And every lawyer in the firm wanted to be involved in the case. To do some aspect of it, you know, answering interrogatories or going to a hearing or doing research. And I got a call from the boss on a Saturday morning, and he said, Spore, he said, I need your help on this case. And I thought, hot damn, that's great. This is my chance to get off the bench and get into the game. And he said, we're meeting all of our experts, and the clients are going to meet. We're going to have the truck at the scene tonight at 7 o'clock, and we'd like you to meet us there. I said, fine, I'll be there, boss, whatever you need me to do. And so I showed up, and there were experts in audiology and conspicuity and truck operations, and the driver of the truck was there, and a videographer was there. And Ray Ehrlich said, all right, Spore, we want you to put on this watch cap and this pea coat and put this duffel bag on your shoulder, walk down the road as the young sailor did, and we're going to see how close we can come to you with this truck without hitting you. And so that was my finest hour as a young associate.
That's a plum assignment. That was a great,
great. They said I did a terrific job. And
could you hear the wind going past your ears? Yeah. Oh my gosh! Goodness gracious! You also, though, probably along the same lines, have a reputation as a bit of a daredevil outside the office and the courtroom, and it's not as a pilot, but tell us about that.
Well, I've been riding motorcycles since I was in high school, and I don't brag about it because people question your judgment. I'm not sure they want a doctor or a lawyer who goes out and races motorcycles, but I've had some wonderful trips with my son and my brother and others riding in the Alps, in the Pyrenees, the Rocky Mountains. It's a good way to clear your head. If you're on a fast motorcycle on a mountain road, you're not usually worried about depositions or something.
And speaking of your son Matthew is a partner in this firm as well. You must be very proud of
him. I'm very proud of him. Matt's one of our younger partners, and it's a pleasure to work with him on cases and watching him come along. We have a very collegial group of people here. Everybody works hard, plays hard. We all help each other, and it's a great group of people. Our paralegals as well. I have to talk about them. They make us look so good. Our paralegals are outstanding. They work very hard. The clients adore them, and oftentimes the clients will call. They don't want to speak to the lawyer. They want to talk to the paralegal who really knows what's going on in the case. They work very hard, and as I said, they make us all look good.
Now, you've been practicing law now for 43 years. What made you want to be a lawyer in the first place?
I came along in an era in the 60s and 70s when there was huge societal change going on. The anti-war movement for the Vietnam War, civil rights movement, women's rights, children's rights, and law was the engine that was driving all of that progressive change. And lawyers were the operators of that engine. And I wanted to be part of that. And I was brought up in New York City. I was educated in the Midwest and was very fortunate to get into law school and came out. Like many others, though, I was diverted and detoured into doing one specialty or another. But I have enormous respect for our colleagues who came out of elite law schools and still do and choose to go into public interest law. And they serve as either public defenders or legal aid lawyers.
Do you still have your idealism from the 60s?
You know, I do. And I think that we work for change in society in a different way. Hopefully, through some of our cases, we've made society a safer place. Through the work of trial lawyers, we have had an impact on society. If you look at the modern automobile, for example, all of the safety features, from seat belts to anti-lock brakes to the glass that's used, side airbags, all of that came about not because of some government agency edict, but because of litigation where trial lawyers walked into a courtroom and said, Ford, GM, Chrysler, you need to make your car safer because had you had this safety feature in your car, my client would not have been killed or injured. And you have enough of those lawsuits that are successful and industry makes changes. So I would say that what we do as trial lawyers has a positive impact on society in making it a better and safer place for all of us.
What were the most important influences in your life growing up? What lessons did you learn growing up that prepared you for law or have guided you during your law career?
You know, my parents were a great influence on me. Neither one of them graduated from college, but all four of the children went to college or graduate school. My father was a great believer in hard work, and having come through the Depression, he thought it was very important to have a trade, to have a skill. So when I got accepted to law school, I remember a conversation I had with him, and he said, Bobby, he said, I'm very proud of you for getting into law school. However, in case this law thing doesn't work out, you should learn a trade, like carpentry or electrical work or a mason. And fortunately, the law school thing and the law career did work out. But the best advice I got from him was hard work. And when I came to Jacksonville in 1974, I had not gone to the right law schools. I really didn't know anybody in town other than my brother, who was the reason I came here, and was very fortunate to get a job. But once I got that job, it didn't matter where I went to law school. It didn't matter who I knew. What people wanted to know is, can you help me? You know, how hard are you going to work for me? And I think that there's a lesson there for young lawyers, which is it really doesn't matter at the end of the day. Clients never care where you went to law school or what your grade point average was. They want to know if you've had a case like theirs, and if so, can you help them?
Who was your mentor? Did you have one?
Yeah, I mentioned Ray Ehrlich, who I had the privilege of practicing with for a short time. Also at the firm at the time were Jim Cobb and Bud Robison, great trial lawyers.
Mm-hmm. And Ehrlich became a state Supreme Court justice.
Ray Ehrlich became a chief justice of the Florida Supreme Court. That's correct. He and Robison have now passed away. But they were great influences on me because I was a brand new lawyer and really didn't know what I was doing, but they were a great help to me.
Bob, how did you go about honing your trial skills?
When I was coming along as a young lawyer, all of us were in court every day, and we were trying every kind of case we could get our hands on. Misdemeanors, county court cases, circuit court cases, whatever. And I've always felt that trial advocacy skills translate from one case to another. In other words, if you are an effective advocate in a professional negligence case, those same skills of direct examination, cross-examination, argument will transfer to a aviation accident case or to a criminal case. If you're willing to put in the work, you can be successful. The other thing I think is so important is mastering the facts. At the end of the day, we're not going to win cases by sitting in a law library or sitting at our computer looking at cases. In my view, the lawyer who masters the facts has the opportunity and the edge in the courtroom to win the case. So that's what I instill in our younger lawyers.
What's the most rewarding part of being a plaintiff attorney?
We've just concluded a case involving a military aircraft in which the manufacturer assured the families at the end of the mediation that remedial measures had been taken so that no other military family would have to suffer that kind of a tragic loss. And that's extremely gratifying to me as a lawyer.
Bob, you're a member of the very prestigious Inner Circle of Advocates, one of the top 100 trial attorneys in the U.S. You're a member of the International Association of Barristers, a fellow in the International Academy of Trial Lawyers, Martindale Hubbell's Best Lawyers in America. The list goes on and on. What would you say is your key to success?
I think if I had to identify one thing, I would say that I have been very fortunate throughout my career to be surrounded by very, very good, smart, hardworking lawyers and paralegals. We care about our clients. We put in the hours, the hard work, and I think are looked to as a firm that can find a remedy for a client where other people may have looked and not found one.
Was there a point in your life that you didn't think you were going to make it, either professionally or maybe because of your daredevil activities?
You know, I've always had a lot of confidence in myself. Whether it's misplaced, I'll let others decide that. But I think confidence is contagious, and I think that that's important for a trial lawyer to be confident and to exude confidence in the courtroom and with the clients so that they are willing to trust you and trust your word when you give them legal advice.
On the other side, how helpful or hurtful can self-reflection be?
You know, I have to confess, I don't brood about myself a lot. Certainly, we've had great successes, but we've also lost cases. And I try to, you know, do a postmortem, think about what we might have done differently. But then ultimately, I'll get on a motorcycle, ride around for a while, and then pick up another file and get back to work. And I think hard work is the best therapy if you have a disappointment in life.
Do you have day-to-day, let me start that part over. Is there a secret to your day-to-day success? Is it getting out on that motorcycle or getting in that airplane, kind of clearing your head?
I'm a morning person, and I have been all my life, and I like getting up, watching the sun come up, and I'll kind of use that time of day to reflect about what I've been accomplishing the last few days or few weeks, and then what I hope to be able to accomplish in the next 24 hours and the next week or so. And I think that type of review, if you will, and reflection is important. I found that to be helpful in organizing my my day and organizing my projects.
You talked about successes and failures, and all lawyers have them, even the best like yourself. How do you handle disappointment?
Not well. I mean, the expression is, if I lose a trial, I go home and I sleep like a baby. I wake up every hour and cry. The fact is, if you have done the work, put in the time, done your best in court, and you anticipated everything that may come up, you're not going to win every case anyway. And if you're winning every case, you're not trying as many as you should. So when we don't have a successful outcome, we sit with a client, we review other options, whether we want to appeal, whether we want to consider other options. But at the end of the day, as long as we've done our very best for the client, that's all we can promise them. And I tell clients that when they hire us. I say, look, I cannot guarantee you at this point in time the outcome of your case, but what I can do is promise you our very best efforts on your behalf.
Is there one particular case that you'll never forget?
I think there's two that stand out. One is representing the family of Johnny Mae Chappelle, who was an African-American woman who was murdered in cold blood here in Jacksonville in the 1960s during the race riots. And the four perpetrators were arrested, confessed, but three of them were never brought to trial. And I had the privilege of representing the Chappelle children and working with the Florida Bureau of Investigation, the state attorney's office, the FBI, the cold case section of the civil rights branch of the Justice Department in continuing that investigation and exhausting all legal remedies on behalf of the family. So that one certainly will stay with me. The other one is, years ago, I represented a young lady who had a medical device that had failed, and she needed to go back in and have emergency surgery. And I was asked by a retired judge if I would take the case on. I told him, yes, I can write a few letters, and I'll get the medical bills paid, and that's all she wanted to have done. And if you can believe it, 2.5 years later, I was standing in the United States Supreme Court, where the issue was whether or not medical device manufacturers could be brought into a courtroom for a jury to determine whether the medical device was defective or whether that whole area of the law was preempted by the Food and Drug Administration. And I'm pleased to say we won that case and established a rule of law at the time that medical device manufacturers are not entitled to special defenses and that they have to account for the product failures in a courtroom just like any other manufacturers.
And that was before the United States Supreme Court?
Correct.
Wow. You mentioned Mrs. Chappelle. That was a pro bono case.
Yes, that's correct.
Those are very important to you.
You know, we have a tradition in this firm of doing a lot of pro bono work and encouraging all of our lawyers to do pro bono work. I think it's expected of us. I think it's something that we, all lawyers, should aspire to do, and we encourage it.
Let's switch gears a little bit, because lawyers are human beings as well. You handle some very complex cases. I've talked about that a lot of it is time on task. How do you balance your professional life with your personal and family life?
Our children are my proudest accomplishment, and we love spending time with them, and that family time is very important to me. And when the kids were coming up, we spent a lot of time on family vacations, skiing and rafting the Grand Canyon and camping. So I travel, I do some teaching, some writing, but I'm very, very fortunate in that I'm at a point in my career where I can kind of pick and choose the cases that I want to work on, work as hard as I want to work. So I'm down to probably 50 or 60 hours a week now instead of before that. But look, what I do, I'm privileged, and it's amazing to have a law license and a bar license, and it's an enormous privilege and opportunity, and it's not something I'm going to give up lightly. And as long as I'm healthy and people think I can be of help to them with their cases, I'm going to continue doing what I'm doing.
What's your view on the future of the legal profession? Any concerns?
You know, it's gone through a huge sea change in the time that I've been practicing. And with the advent of advertising, with the extreme competition among law firms for business, I guess I'm most concerned about the number of young, idealistic lawyers coming out of law school with just crushing debt. and the job opportunities for them are limited. And I think that that can, you know, kind of crush that enthusiasm and idealism that they need to have as young lawyers, and that concerns me. If you have a burning desire to be a lawyer, you should go for it, because there will always be a position for good lawyers who are dedicated. If it's just something that somebody wants to do because they're not sure where they want to spend the next 3 years, I would say, no, don't do it.
And the jury recognizes that passion.
I think so, yeah. If a lawyer is just phoning it in, as they say, they can recognize that.
Bob, we've talked about the law. Let's talk ethics. Do the ends sometimes justify the means?
You know, I will say this to you, and I've said this to young law students, that when you come out and begin practicing, you have a bank account of credibility with judges, with other lawyers, with clients, and everybody wants you to do well, because we all remember back when we were new lawyers and we all had mentors. But every time you appear in front of a judge or in front of a mediator or go to a deposition or a hearing with other attorneys, you're either making a deposit in that bank account of credibility or you're making a withdrawal. And if you get to the point where you're overdrawn on your credibility bank account, you can't recover from that. And so ethics, professionalism, doing the right thing is critical to what we do. The legal profession, the justice system, as Justice Ehrlich said in one of his opinions when he was on the Supreme Court, depends upon the slender reed of the ethics and professionalism of the trial bar. And it is a slender reed. And if we lose sight of that, then the system is in trouble.
It seems like you've just answered this next question, but what one piece of advice do you have for the incoming lawyers?
I would say, when you take on a case, master the facts, be honest with your client, be straight up with the court and opposing counsel, and do the right thing. And most importantly, don't chase the money. Take care of your client and the money will follow. Lawyers who are driven by the other extreme fall into trouble, I think.
Bob, how would you like to be remembered?
That's an interesting question. I guess I'd like to be remembered as the old curmudgeon still practicing law down the hall at age 100. I have mentors of mine who are still practicing, and they're in their 80s and not working as hard as they used to, but they're still mentally very sharp. You know, our Supreme Court justices, many of them are in their 80s, making critical decisions for all of us. So I think that we're in an era where all of us are staying active, staying busy, staying productive much later in life, and hopefully I'll be able to continue to help clients and continue to work well into my senility.
Bob Sporer, you are a titan of trial. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Paul Jess. We hope you enjoyed listening to this Titans of Trial episode. If you're not already a member, we'd like to invite you to join the Florida Justice Association. Please visit us on the web at floridajusticeassociation.org or drop us a line at radio@floridajusticeassociation.org.
Thank you for listening to this Titans of Trial podcast, sponsored by the Florida Justice Association Research and Education Foundation, promoting the study and understanding of Florida's civil justice system and how its preservation benefits consumers, victims, and all Floridians. Learn more at floridajusticeassociation.org.